Hello everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Mem Podcast. If you haven't already, don't forget to check out our Instagram at mem.cast and our Twitter at mem_cast for our weekly question of the week. This week, I have joined us again Dr. James Morris, who's an aesthetic reg in the East Midlands. Hi James, thanks for joining us again.
Hi Dr. Wright, thanks for having me back on the show. I really enjoyed our last chat we had a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and if you guys haven't checked it out, he's done a couple of previous podcasts on cardiac arrest and the unconscious patient, so check those out if you haven't already. This week we're doing lumbar puncture. So it is one of the core procedures that are necessary in the IMT training program, and also is necessary as a registrar to maintain these skills, so I thought it'd be a good one to cover. So James, let's just start off with the indications. When do you typically do lumbar punctures?
Okay, so lumbar punctures in the anaesthetic world tend more to be used as a form of delivering an anaesthetic, as a spinal anaesthetic. But we also do lumbar punctures as an investigation, you know, as a tool to help the diagnosis, particularly for our intensive care patients. Some of those indications include the diagnosis of subarachnoid hemorrhage, in getting a sample of spinal fluid for testing for meningitis. And we can also use it for further tests looking for other such diseases.
Okay. Yeah, so in the medical world, probably the most common that we do it for is mostly diagnostics. So like you said, the subarachnoids, you know, people coming in with headaches, it's one of the things that we have to exclude. But like you said, the infection, so encephalitis, meningitis. But we also do it for diagnosis of idiopathic intracranial hypertension. That's a common one. And then also that can go into therapeutic as well, because they tend to need therapeutic lumbar punctures. What are the contraindications to doing a lumbar puncture?
As with most contraindications, we can break it down into absolute and relative. Some absolute contraindications would include patient refusal, overwhelming coagulopathy, examples of which would be a patient in DIC or severely thrombocytopenic. Consider anything under a platelet count of 100,000 to at least discuss that with a senior colleague or a hematologist. There may be benefit over risk to do that procedure in that patient. However, it's something worth considering. So infection directly over the lumbar spine where you're going to perform the procedure due to the risk of spreading infection is an absolute contraindication. Another absolute contraindication would be significantly raised intracranial pressure.
So I'm glad you said that, because I find one of the things that we end up doing in practice, particularly on the medical wards, is for anyone who does need a lumbar puncture, we tend to do a CT head prior to doing the lumbar puncture. Is there anything that you can say about, you know, when a CT head is indicated?
Okay. Yeah, it's difficult. In practice, a lot of the time, we're trying to get a lumbar puncture to form part of our diagnosis. And time is often of the essence in these cases. Examples of which would include an infectious cause where you're trying to getting a sample for meningitis, where delaying to get a CT scan and doing the sampling after antibiotics are on board may give you false negative result. However, if there's any signs or symptoms of raised intracranial pressure, such as caused by trauma, significant history of sudden onset of vomiting, severe headaches, altered mentation, lowering of the GCS, if there's a focal neurological deficit, or on examination of the back of the eyes, if you see papilledema, they would count as risk factors for increased intracranial pressure.
Yeah.
You could also consider seizures, unknown cause of why this patient may be seizing. It could be a space-occupying lesion in the brain or a significant amount of blood causing raised intracranial pressure.
Okay. And so in terms of general safety, you already touched on one of the factors. So you mentioned about the platelets, you know, any coagulation defects particularly. You mentioned about the platelets. What other safety checks do you tend to do before performing this LP, and apart from the CT head that we just discussed also?
Yeah. So simple things to check before you even start is ensure that the patient is consented. Make sure that you have the environment to perform the lumbar puncture. As we'll get onto later, it's really important to have an environment conducive to lumbar puncture. it's really important to check if the patient's on any anticoagulants or antiplatelet medications. For example, a lot of our inpatients are on prophylactic subcutaneous heparin.
And so, like, what's the minimum time that we should be waiting before doing a lumbar puncture in people on anticoagulants? So you said the low molecular weight heparin, let's start with that one.
So our guidelines recommend that we wait at least 12 hours after a low molecular weight heparin, which fortunately normally works out quite well because in most trusts, the low molecular weight heparin is given in the evening time, usually 6 or 8 o'clock. And by the time you're coming around to do your procedure, it will be morning. However, that's not the only antiplatelet and anticoagulant.
Yep. Do you want to just go through the other ones?
Like, sure.
When do you tend to wait? How long do you tend to wait?
So IV heparin, typically you can do a lumbar puncture after 2 to 4 hours after the IV heparin has stopped. Warfarin, typically 5 to 7 days, but you'd ideally look to check the coag status before performing that procedure because the clearance of the warfarin is less predictable. DOACs create a really, really difficult challenge in knowing when it's safe to perform lumbar puncture because they all typically ranges between 48 hours and 96 hours, and it's dependent on the patient's GFR, or creatinine clearance really, as well as the actual DOAC being used. I always have to reference a table just to check because there are so many to keep in my head. The ones that you don't need to wait for are aspirin at low dose, so your 75 milligram aspirin, just go straight ahead. Non-steroidals, including naproxen, you can still go ahead and do the lumbar puncture without waiting. And clopidogrel, we typically wait 1 week, typically the life of the platelets that have been affected by the clopidogrel.
Right, okay. And so let's move on to the actual technique. Do you have any pro tips on doing the procedure? I know that one of the probably the most common and maybe not the best referrals that you get at nighttime is emergency LP overnight.
Sure. Firstly, it's very unusual that a lumbar puncture is a true emergency. It's typically more an urgency. However, that being said, yeah, we do often get phone calls and referrals for lumbar puncture because of commonly is failure to access. Normally you get a description of I've been hitting too much lots of bone, or the registrar's tried twice and can't get through to the consultant, can I have a go? These are quite common. And with regards to techniques and tips that I found useful over my time is, I'd like to start with positioning. I think positioning is absolutely key to successful lumbar puncture. Most spinal anesthetics, we do lumbar puncture or spinal in the sitting position. Now, that may be a little bit controversial for medics because I understand one of the values that you'd like to assess is the patient's opening pressure,
yeah.
Which is obviously altered by the position that the patient is in. However, I would say in general, most important is that sample of CSF. And if it's been difficult in the lying position, on the lateral position, then sitting position to get a sample is beneficial because it is easier. So okay. Typically having the patient sitting on the side of the bed with the angle of the knees as far back towards the bed as possible, and having them slouching or curled over like an angry cat is what's always described.
I've not heard that.
So if you think of a cartoon angry cat which has arched its back and is trying to scare away something. And so that opens up the spaces in between the spine, and in doing so give you the best chance of gaining access.
All right. So we've positioned the patient. Everything is under sterile conditions. We've consented the patient. Which needle and why?
Okay. So there are a variety of needles available, and there's not necessarily a right or wrong. The challenge is that we've got to get a good feel of the space as well as being able to access the sample in the most atraumatic way. So there are blunt needles and sharp needles, or blunt and cutting needles, I guess is a better description. And typically we choose blunt needles because they're associated with a reduced risk of postdural puncture headache. An example of which would be the Sprott needle. However, I'm aware that the Quinky needle, which is an example of a sharp needle, is commonly used.
Yeah, I think we just use whichever needle that says lumbar puncture and just choose whichever one's there.
And that's fair enough. And typically the larger needles, such as the 22 gauge, will give better feel. However, that in itself is also associated with a greater risk of postdural puncture headache. So ideally, the smaller the needle with a blunt tip, And when you have difficulty, you know, minimal attempts is associated with less of a risk of a posterior puncture headache as well.
Okay, so that's the needles. Let's talk about lidocaine. It's one of the things that I think is poorly understood in amongst medics, maybe. I've had experiences where I've seen people have been given 20 mils of 2% lidocaine and then be surprised that they couldn't perform the LP. What are your thoughts on that?
For lumbar puncture, you really only need a tiny amount of local anesthetic, a bleb right under the skin where you're performing the LP. And essentially, if you keep in mind that you can go up to around 3 to 5 milligrams per kilo of lidocaine, you really should be okay using 1% lidocaine and somewhere around less than 5 mils. That's more than enough, and that's 50 milligrams max. So, you know, it's quite easy in a very light patient to overdose them on lidocaine if you're repeatedly attempting lumbar puncture with 2% and going up to, you know, 20 mils of lidocaine. It's not necessary.
Yeah. I mean, in my practice, I would use less than a mil, actually, and literally just doing in the skin, and that's usually more than enough.
Yeah, and in general, it actually helps to use less because it allows you to maintain the anatomy, being able to feel the space.
Okay. And what about tinted chloroprep?
Yeah,
why should we use that?
So the guidelines suggest that we should use chlorhexidine at 0.5%, as long as the patient isn't allergic to it, and at which point a suitable alternative is povidone iodine. The tinted chloroprep is very useful to ensure that the entire back is cleaned adequately, that nothing has been missed, but also to allow to observe for drying, because it's actually the dried chloroprep that allows us to ensure that the skin is sterile. And you should wait till it's dried to reduce the risk of arachnoiditis.
So in the procedure, so we've chosen the right needle, we've positioned them, given them less than a mil of lidocaine. Do you have any other tips on how else you're doing the procedure?
Yeah, so I'll just say, remember your anatomy. So you're typically going to be doing this lumbar puncture somewhere in the region of L3 to L4 or L4 to L5. And this can be found typically by finding the iliac crest and creating an imaginary line between the two iliac crests. And remembering that most patients do have an element of a curvature in the spine, whether it's a scoliosis, accentuated lumbar lordosis, or simply due to inadequate positioning may lead to curvature in the spine. So just bear that in mind when you're creating a 3D anatomy in your mind. One of the techniques that we use is as you're going through the spaces, you're firstly going through the skin and subcutaneous tissue into the fat, the muscle. After you get through there, you're going through ligaments, and the key one to get a feel of is ligamentum flavum. It's described as a rubbery or gummy texture to it. In doing so, the needle will suddenly grasp a lot more tightly than it when it's in the fat. It normally is a good indication that you're on the right path. And then finally, when you do puncture the dura, you may feel a pop sensation, or it's maybe more like a slight change in resistance before you remove the stylet to check for your CSF. Failing that, one of the tools that we use, I would say, and this is really for the more challenging lumbar punctures, is ultrasound. Ultrasound can be used in the sagittal plane as well as coronal plane to determine midline. Not used in real time typically, but at least it allows you to identify depth of space as well as your lumbar level.
Right, okay. That sounds really interesting. I found that rubbery texture that you described with the ligamentum flavum, I found that the most useful for me actually when I was learning, and what another registrar had told me, anesthetic reg, had told me was that it feels like you're going through cheese. So actually now, and every time I do a lumbar puncture, I feel for that cheese-like feeling, and that's helped me a lot. So I hope that will help you guys as well. So, through the samples, because I know as the anaesthetic reg, you wouldn't know much about the samples, given when we bring the patient to theatre to have the LP done normally, we have to come to send the samples off. So, we need 4 universal containers, and we also need 2 glucose containers, one for serum, one for the CSF, and then for the each of them need to be labeled 1 to 4 with at least 0.5 mils in each, which is roughly around 10 drops of the CSF, with the first one being for microbiology due to cell count, and for biochemistry, glucose and lactate, the third one for protein, and the fourth one can be for micro as well, or for xanthochromia. Always note that the xanthochromia needs to be in a light-proof container, so I normally send them off in a sealed envelope. So let's talk about the complications. You already mentioned the postural puncture headache. Do you want to talk us through a little bit about those?
Yeah, so postural puncture headache, the literature suggests that for a using a spinal needle, the rate is somewhere in the region of 1 in 200. It typically is more likely in younger patients and female patients. And in doing so, that mechanism is poorly understood. However, the theory behind it is creating a CSF leak causes downward traction on essentially on the brain, and it leads to a postural headache that is worse on standing and relieves somewhat lying down. Now, the nature of it is that's the nature of it. How the onset is typically after the first 24 hours or so. Most of these headaches resolve completely by themselves with just a simple analgesia such as paracetamol and ibuprofen. However, a small fraction of those may need treatment with conservative treatment failing. In the invasive treatment is essentially doing an epidural blood patch, whereby it's a sterile technique where a sample of the patient's own blood, usually around about 20 mils, is transferred from the patient into their epidural space. And again, the mechanism of that is not fully understood, but the simplest way I like to think of it is effectively acts like a plug, reducing the CSF leak. And in most patients with resistant posterior puncture headache, that is sufficient to help. In an absolutely tiny portion, MRI and subsequent referral to a neurosurgical team or spinal team for intervention such as dual patching may be necessary.
Okay. Is it your practice, or have you found any evidence to suggest that on removal of the needle after doing the lumbar puncture, whether asking the patient to lie on their back for an hour, 2 hours, does that make any difference to the incidence of posterior puncture headache?
I'm unsure. I've not read anything along those lines. I can understand a theory of not exerting yourself, or asking a patient not to exert themselves, and bed rest immediately after could allow time for the small dual puncture to heal before the puncture worsens and potentially causes a headache.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, James. That was extremely helpful. And guys, if you haven't already, don't forget to check out our Instagram at mem.cast and our Twitter at mem_cast for our weekly question of the week. If you haven't checked out James's previous podcast on cardiac arrest and unconscious patient, please check that out as well. And if you have any special requests, do get in touch. See you next time.